This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. When you think about explosions in Baghdad, your mind most likely turns to IEDs or tank fire. If you ask Karim Wasfi, chances are he's thinking about Tchaikovsky. Karim Wasfi is the co-conductor and director of the Iraqi National Symphony Orchestra, which continues to rehearse and perform despite the threat of suicide bombings, kidnapping, power outages, and roadblocks. Today, many Americans know a lot more about Iraq than we did 5.5 years ago. Once foreign words in places like Sunni, Shia, Fallujah, and Sadr City are now familiar terms on TV, radio, internet, and newspapers. But give us a call. What do you know about Iraqi culture? What would you like to know more about? If you do know about Iraqi music or film or poetry, how did you learn about it? Our phone number is 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org, and you can join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later in the program, we want to hear your thoughts on this 7th anniversary of 9/11. What does this day mean to you? Do we talk about it too much or too little? You can send us email now. The address is the same, talk@npr.org. But first, Karim Wasfi joins us. He's at NPR's Bureau in New York, and nice to have you on Talk of the Nation today. Welcome.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Do you risk your life to play music?
Yes, we do.
Why?
The mission is more important than personal feelings about one's own life, I would guess.
Why is it the mission is more important?
Because it involves the lives of thousands and probably millions of others.
Explain to us. I'm trying to get you to elucidate a little more. You know, when you gather a crowd for a concert, that you, your musicians, and the people in that crowd are potentially targets.
Right, and whoever is going to target a cultivated, civilized approach towards life would be definitely targeting a limited number of individuals. That would be the symphony or myself or others. I'm targeting millions of people, and maybe targeting is not the right terminology, but I'm culturally and targeting a wider range of targets, which is basically the whole society, which is the concept of how should we live our lives and why should we live in peace and how can we actually secure that. Those who fear freedom would definitely be targeting those who are free and who are willing to cultivate life through this freedom, which in this case would be, of course, what we're doing. So basically, the mission involves, and by mission I mean it's a personal determination and dedication towards developing the scene and giving a chance for people to experience some normalcy, and also the arts and culture and music in particular as an international language is one of the perfect tools towards achieving that and towards helping people to overcome their disagreements, problems, and it's a unifying force after all. So this is how I look at it.
And in addition to the dangers, the frustrations must be enormous. I know that many of your musicians offer the opportunity to play in Jordan or elsewhere in the world. Many of them took advantage of that. And I know that getting instruments and just getting around the city can be difficult at times.
Very true. Yes, indeed. And we have lost a good number of professionals. But as we have proven, as Iraq had proven, as the simple Iraqi person had proven, that life never stops and it goes on. So we proceed with our development plans towards a better situation until we reach a point when life is normal. Then we'll have different concepts and different plans for developing the cultural scene. Now it's kind of a challenge, and at the same time it's a very sensitive situation. Would you accept the challenge and prove that life can go on, and could you proceed with your life, and could you consider different ways to deal with yourself, with your own problems, and with others, and with the situation in Iraq? Or is it an escapism solution to get out out of the overall situation through doing what we're doing. I think it's a combination of everything, but after all, it's simply if we can make it, if we're successful in achieving our goals and through these different endeavors and efforts in such harsh times, then imagine how it would be with similar efforts when life is normal.
Well, let's see if we get some callers in on the conversation. We're talking with Karim Wasfi, the co-conductor and director of the Iraqi National Symphony Orchestra. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. Jacob's on the line. Jacob calling from Milwaukee.
Yes, I just had a quick question about what the symphony performances were like pre-invasion under Saddam, if they were they felt freer in a sense to play or if they were stifled in a way. Just thought it was an interesting question. I'll take my answer off air. Thanks.
Thanks for the call, Jacob.
Thanks. To be honest, yes. Music and classical music in particular was never politicized.
So it was play. What
to some extent, in comparison to other arts and other music, was somehow left alone. and I know the gentleman would probably want a clearer answer for that. But this was a situation. This is how we remember it. This is how we survived it. And in other words, we were not harassed for some reason. I think this would be partially due to the fact that Iraq was, and I emphasize was, the most liberal secular country in the Middle East until 2003, 2004, in certain cases, in certain aspects of life. And that included, of course, Western music, classical music, and music in general as a form of art, you know, in comparison to painting, plastic art, sculpture, etc.
You say so. Classical music. You play Western music or do you play Iraqi composers as well?
Both.
Both. And let me ask you, has your audience changed since 2003, 2004?
Well, of course, again, the whole scene was affected by the situation and the instability. So most of the intelligentsia and the intellectuals, the middle class, who were basically our audience, had already left or departed or chose not to part, you know, not to mm-hmm. be part of the overall, you know, public life due to the instability. Mm-hmm. So the audience, yes, has changed, but there were some positive changes as well that we have, you know, recently achieved or facilitated through creating a wide range, a wide spectrum of audience, of people who would actually be dealing with us and with what we do. Which is a very interesting experience. I can elaborate on that if you choose to.
Well, in just a minute, maybe. I'd just like to introduce one of the few journalists who can lay claim to the title of Baghdad cultural correspondent. Melek Kalan is a culture contributor to the Wall Street Journal. He's also with us at NPR's Bureau in New York. And thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
And in addition to covering the Iraqi National Symphony Orchestra, you also wrote about the last functioning art gallery in Baghdad and the lengths that people will go to see and hear art. And I was fascinated by the opening line of your story in the Wall Street Journal last June 13th. Among the agonies imposed on Baghdad by tormentors in the guise of self-appointed religious enforcers is the proscription of fun.
Yes, indeed.
They banned fun.
Yes, I think fun tends to get in the way of full imposed fascistic order. You know, people will go around disobeying orders and having fun. And I think also essentially their attitude was that it was a war. It was a holy war to many of those people. And the last thing they wanted was people being having too much fun and being too... you know, too light in their approach to life. You know, it intruded it offended their aesthetic.
Fun is not entirely what art is about, but it's partly what it's about.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's two sides to that, which is that there's the fun part, which has a slightly anarchic side to it, and therefore people, I think, who wish to impose an iron rule on something object to it. But there's also the self-expression part. Which is people trying to get out from within those things that they feel and an expression of the difficulties of life and so on. And art is one of those things. That was one of the things I wanted to look at. You know, all these years, people have been writing about Baghdad and Iraq, and they very few of them have actually asked the question, well, but what is it actually like from day to day? What do people do to endure the conditions? Not how many die, how many get blown up, and what the political scene is like, and so on, but actually, you know, what is the quality, the texture of life like, and how do you escape the horrors, and what do you do to live fully and creatively in that sort of environment? And that's why I went to look at that situation.
And I have to ask you, are the art gallery that you wrote about and the Iraqi National Symphony Orchestra, are they vestiges of that cosmopolitan, sophisticated, more secular society that we've heard about? Or are they thriving? Are they coming back?
I think they were vestiges. I think what happened is that large numbers of the middle class left, and the people that were empowered were those who were willing to take up the gun and those who had, in essence, no other way to survive than at the point of a gun. And in general, those people tended not to have any interest in culture at all. But I think it would be a mistake to think that there's a kind of culture-consuming elite and everybody else is religious and unwashed. That isn't what happened under Saddam. Saddam imposed a kind of progressive cultivational order so that, you know, large numbers of people were forcibly educated in the arts, in the Western arts and in the secular arts. And what that left behind was actually a critical mass of people who are not, whose culture is not merely religious or sectarian. Now, those people left, ran away, and actually their money ran out. So they began to come back in large and larger numbers. And I think that's tilted the balance somewhat. And so I think that kind of secular interest in culture is coming back.
We'll talk more with Melek Kaylan of The Wall Street Journal and with Karim Wasfi of the Iraqi National Symphony Orchestra in just a moment. So stay with us. If you'd like to join the conversation about culture in Iraq, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Later this hour, we want to hear your thoughts on this 7th anniversary of 9/11. Tell us what this day means to you. Do we talk about it too much or too little? You can send us email now. The address is talk@npr.org. Right now, we're talking about the role and the importance of culture in Iraq and about the cultural exchange happening between the U.S. and Iraqis in that country, if any. We're talking with Karim Wasfi, co-conductor and director of the Iraqi National Symphony Orchestra, and with Melek Kaylan. He writes about culture in Iraq for The Wall Street Journal. What do you know about Iraqi culture? What more would you like to know about it? And if you do know about Iraqi music or film, how do you know about it? Give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And we have an email from Kellen in Casper, Wyoming. And Karim Wasfi, I think this is for you. Are the participants in the orchestra obligated to play night in and night out? Is there a backup player if one of the participants does not show due to their own personal issues with the safety of the event?
Unfortunately not. This would have been the case in a normal situation where we could have enough substitutes, enough people who would probably make it up for those who cannot. So unfortunately at this stage, no, not yet. We have not. We have managed to fill some of the missing, those who left, of course, to make it up and substitute for those who had departed Iraq. But and this was another project by itself to qualify younger students to be able to qualify to be members of the orchestra. And we have succeeded, but this is a burden by itself, you know, not to have enough musicians around. But I'm sensing that the situation is going to change at some point, and we'll have more people to come back, especially with the more attention from the international community and also more help from the government, possibly in Iraq, and then more recognition for what we're trying to achieve over there.
And I think that first part of the question referred might have been focused on the fact: is this a professional orchestra, and was it before?
Yes, it is a professional orchestra. I have to mention it's still called the Iraqi National Symphony Orchestra, so it's the official symphony orchestra of Iraq, and it's part of the Ministry of Culture's hierarchy of administration. And it was not actually fully paid by the government until 1963. Before that, it was a combination of a few amateurs and those who were had some music education, as well as the foreign faculty that we had in Iraq for the Fine Arts Institute. That was back then in the 50s, the only music organization that would actually cover music and plastic arts. Until 1967, when we had when the music and ballet school was formed in Baghdad, and then we had a full faculty scene from back then the Soviet Union, and from East Europe in particular, working, you know, as faculty for the school, and also working as members of the Iraqi National Symphony Orchestra under the same contractual, you know. It was fully functioning as a professional orchestra as of 1963.
Let's get another caller on the line. This is Scott, and Scott's with us from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Shlonik.
Okay, go ahead.
Shlonik, gentlemen. My Arabic is shwaya shwaya. Yes, so about 3.5 years ago, well, actually, I should say about 4 years ago, I was in the United States Army, and I spent a year in Baghdad. I'm just calling to discuss, when I was in Baghdad, I found it very interesting. Before I went to Iraq, I had never really left my own country, save for like a trip to Canada. And, so I didn't really know what to expect. But when I got to Baghdad, I mean, it was definitely nothing like what I'd ever seen before. But I was actually quite interested in the fact that a lot of the younger Iraqis, mostly in their late teens and early 20s, actually listened to a lot of American popular music. I remember we had many interpreters that worked with us, and one especially, he listened to a lot of things like, he listened to Slayer and Metallica, and then there was, I remember, a young Iraqi Civil Defense Corps soldier who listened to a lot of 50 Cent, a lot of rap.
There's no accounting
more than many Americans, probably, yeah. If you consider the populace. Yeah. Yes, of course.
Well, see, this is the thing. That interpreter that I was telling you about, who listened to a lot of the heavy metal, he was telling me about when he was a younger child, and under the under Saddam, there was actually a radio station called VOY, Voice of Youth, and it played a lot of Western-style popular music.
Yes,
and,
true.
I'm just wondering what my question is. I mean, is that still going on nowadays? Like I said, it's been about 3.5 years since I left Iraq. And so I really don't know what's happened in those 3.5 years. However, I just found it so very interesting that I was actually able to get on a level with these interpreters and some of these ING soldiers. And, you know, actually listen to, like, the same kind of music that I grew up enjoying listening to as a younger child.
ING, Iraqi National Guard. Let's get an answer. Melek Kaylan, do you feel...
Yeah. I think, look, if you watch television in Baghdad, there's any number of channels that show the most sort of dynamic and vibrant and frankly, sort of, you know, underclothed music videos. And a lot of Iraqi musicians have actually gone out of the country but are pumping music in to the country from nearby countries, from Jordan and the Gulf and what have you. Because actually Iraq's musical tradition is what has been always one of the most dynamic in the region. You know, there's Iraq, Lebanon, and Egypt, basically, are the great sort of centers of cosmopolitan music there. And so the Iraqi music and its ability to perform music and its appreciation of music from around the world is you know, a force in the region. And you know, a lot of young people do, in fact, listen to American-style Arab music also. You know, it's a spectrum of things, all the way from actual Western music to Arabic music that's very similar to Western. And if you watch it if you watch the music videos, you're astonished that, you know, that it's... interchangeable in terms of its, you know, clothing and sort of rather indiscreet gestures and dances and so on. So there is a whole element of that. But I think we have to be careful. A lot of people assume that because young people listen to Western music, that something will happen in the region comparable to what happened in the Soviet Union, that it'll be converted by the young into a greater Western-looking attitude because they just love Western music. I don't think it's going to be as simple as that.
We heard you do an interview on Studio 360, another public radio program, and one of the fascinating things you said on that interview was that, in fact, the United States and Western countries have not sent enough of their culture to Iraq.
Yeah, I'd like to make a distinction in this area between entertainment and culture. I don't think it was the equivalent of what happened with the Iron Curtain countries, where the young people began to absorb Western entertainment and, that blue jeans defeated communism, in effect. I don't think it's going to be the same here, and I don't think we should take comfort in young people enjoying Western music. I think we really have to win it through ideas and a deeper level of culture. I think, actually, the Middle East is much more educated than we realize. And people think more deeply than we realize. And we have to, I think, win over hearts and minds at that level and not just because they like to dance to Western music.
Let me ask Kareem Wasfi. Have you had any Americans come over as visiting conductors or as visiting soloists? Would it be safe for them to do so? Would you be happy to have them come over?
Yes, indeed. And it's about time to probably share more about that. We have had an experience, for instance, with Musicians for Harmony. This was the first NGO in music that had made it to Iraq, and we had Allegra Klein, the executive director of that NGO, visiting and facilitating some donations of instruments and music sheets. And similar, we had also another project with another NGO, American Voices, I would remember, also that brought some musicians to the Kurdish area in Kurdistan. And
a much safer part of Iraq. Yeah.
Right. But it's not yet at the level that you would expect it to be. And it's not yet at the level that that it should actually be. I mean, Iraq at some point was not neglected, abandoned somehow. I mean, the culture would have been much easier, and I don't want to get into the political scene, but culture would have been much easier than many other approaches we have had prior to 2003 to deal with the Iraqi situation. And Iraq was ready for that. Iraqis, an average Iraqi, was and is still ready to be so broad-minded, flexible, and accepting other cultures. We, as I said, and as I believe, and as it's so palpable and obvious within certain scenes in Iraq, we were the most liberal, westernized / secular country in the Middle East.
Culturally speaking.
Yeah. And basically it's known, you know, about the Iraqis and the nation over there. So basically there wasn't enough done, and this is one of the aspects I want to develop, and I want to facilitate or materialize, being in my position in Iraq. And, of course, spending – I'm an IU Bloomington graduate, by the way, so I have already, you know, some background in the States. And at some point I would like to change this into a proper cultural integration, mutual understanding scene.
Let me ask you just a very practical question. I'm told by musicians on our staff that things like strings for violins are very expensive, and you need rosin and parts and reeds and all that stuff. Are those things available? How do you get them?
Believe it or not, we're still living on the donated ones. I mean, or some, we have a couple of shops where people are trying to get some of this material into Iraq, but it's not yet at the level as it should be again. As I said, we should have more, not necessarily more donations, but more interest and genuine interest in participating in the cultural life of Iraq away from the political scene, or not necessarily away, but not necessarily merely related to the political scene over there. Just arts for arts, basically.
Neil, you know, one of the things that really struck me when I went over there and to look at what was going on in culture and met Karim and so on is that because the electricity was for several years not working properly, there wasn't much to ameliorate the effects of the weather, for example.
Very bad on strings, yeah.
Yeah, right. I mean, and on wood, actually. Wood instruments and wind instruments and string instruments. And these guys were... Not only there was that trouble, but they also had to keep two instruments, one to keep at the place of performance and one at home, because you couldn't actually carry them around. You'd get either instantly shot or robbed or what have you. I mean, it was an invitation to trouble, so they had to keep two. And it was hard to maintain one, you know.
Yes, much less two. But again, it'd be like Chicago in the 20s, carrying a violin case around.
Yes.
Who knows what's inside
yes,
of it.
Yes, right.
Our guests are Melek Kalan, who writes about culture for the Wall Street Journal, and Karim Wasfi, the co-conductor and director of the Iraqi National Symphony Orchestra. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's get a caller on. This is Debbie. Debbie with us from Phoenix, Arizona.
Hi. I had a question about visual art. And my question is, are visual artists, contemporary visual artists, working currently in Iraq? And do they have an opportunity to show their work anywhere? I know you were talking about an art gallery, but I'm talking in a more official capacity.
And what do you mean by official? Sorry.
Yeah. Well, you know, like contemporary museums. I don't know if there is one.
Mm-hmm. Well, Melek Kalan, what can you tell us about that?
Yeah, there isn't. At the moment, not really, not functioning properly. I mean, it's difficult enough to keep a little gallery going.
Right.
The one that I wrote about in 2007 was literally the last open art gallery in Baghdad.
Mm-hmm.
The way they're surviving is by helping each other and by having little networks.
Uh-huh.
And the reason for that is that everything is done now a little bit Masonically there.
Yeah.
Because you can't invite the public in a mass invitational way because you don't know who's going to come. You know, it's a dangerous thing. So really what it is building networks or maintaining networks that existed of people that you know and getting viral information out and artists helping each other so that, for example, I remember when I went to an exhibition at that gallery, you know, they told me that the sculpture that was on view there was allowing other artists to come and work in his atelier.
Mm-hmm.
And they were coming in and presenting him with, you know, various things that made his life easier.
Mm-hmm.
And that way they were surviving. So that's really the level at which it's been operating.
I have one more question.
Go ahead, please.
Are the contemporary Iraqi artists aware of the art that is being done as a result of this war in the West, for instance, Ferdinand Botero's show that I saw in New York about 2 years ago called Abu Ghraib? And is there any opportunity for these people to get their art out of Iraq into the West?
I think actually that the only way they're selling art, in effect, I mean, it's improving a little bit now, but the only way they were selling for some years was to the diplomatic personnel
mm-hmm.
in Baghdad and to people who belonged to the arts organizations who had moved abroad.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, of course, absolutely rife with logistical problems because the money had to come in, the art had to go out. Sometimes the art was quite large. The deliveries were obviously rather patchy, but they did have exhibitions abroad.
Mm-hmm.
Many of the artists, of course, moved abroad.
Mm-hmm.
And clearly, I think, therefore, were exposed to what the world was thinking about the war and the U.S. Presence in the war and so on. So, yes, I think they have been exposed to it. I don't think they necessarily... I mean, you know, they have their own experience of it, and so they don't necessarily get influenced entirely by the way that we see it.
Right. I just, one other last comment.
I'm afraid, Debbie, I have to cut you off because we're running out of time
okay.
here. I apologize.
Thanks.
But I did want to give ask Melek Kalin just a few seconds left. Talk for a moment about the courage that's required to keep up an art gallery and a symphony orchestra in these times.
It was something astonishing to me because just getting around town for me was dodgy enough. Very dodgy in 2007, less dodgy in 2008, and now not so bad, but it was very dodgy. And I just thought, you know, these people have to, particularly for the musical things, the crowds have to come there, the audiences, the players, they have to rehearse every day. I mean, every single day is running a gauntlet. So I was in awe of their courage, I must say.
Melek Kalin, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you.
Melek Kalin, a cultural contributor to the Wall Street Journal, with us from NPR's Bureau in New York. And Karim Wasfi, good luck to you.
Thank you very much.
Karim Wasfi of the Iraqi National Symphony Orchestra. This is NPR News.